Dr. No by Ian Fleming concluded. Disc 7.
There was the metallic noise of bolts being slid home and safety catches clicked. Tom fella must have gone nuts. Couldn't have been the limey. You ever seen that big puss fella in the creek? Jesus! And the rest of the tricks the doc fixed up in the tube. And that white gal, she can't have been in much shape this morning. Any of your men been to have a look?
No, sir.
No.
No.
Ho, ho. I's sure surprised at you fellas. There's a fine piece of ass out there on the crab walk.
More rattling and shuffling of feet. Then,
okay, let's go. Two abreast till we gets to the main tunnel. Shoot at the legs. Whoever's making trouble, the doc'll sure want him to play with.
Tee-hee. Feet echoed hollowly on the concrete. Bond held his breath as they filed by. Would they notice the shut door of the buggy? But they went on down the garage and into the tunnel, and the noise of them slowly faded away. Bond touched the girl's arm and put his finger to his lips. Slowly he eased open the door and listened again. Nothing. He dropped to the ground and walked round the buggy and went to the half-open entrance. Cautiously he edged his head round. There was no one in sight. There was a smell of frying food in the air that brought the saliva to Bond's mouth. Dishes and pans clattered in the nearest building, about 20 yards away, and from one of the further quonsets came the sound of a guitar and a man's voice singing a calypso. Dogs started to bark half-heartedly, and then were silent. The Doberman pinchers. Bond turned and ran back to the end of the garage. No sound came from the tunnel. Softly, Bond closed the tunnel door and locked and bolted it. He went to the arms rack on the wall and chose another Smith & Wesson and a Remington carbine. He verified that they were loaded and went to the door of the marsh buggy and handed them in to the girl. Now the entrance door. Bond put his shoulder to it and softly eased it wide open. The corrugated iron rumbled hollowly. Bond ran back and scrambled through the open hatch and into the driver's seat.
"Shut it, honey," he whispered urgently, and bent and turned the ignition key.
The needle on the gauge swung to full. Pray God the damn thing would start up quickly. Some diesels were slow. Bond stamped his foot down on the starter. The grinding rattle was deafening. It must be audible all over the compound. Bond stopped and tried again. The engine fluttered and died. And again, and this time the blessed thing fired and the strong iron pulse hammered as Bond revved it up. Now, gently into gear. Which one? Try this. Yes, it bit. Break off, you bloody fool. Christ, it had nearly stalled. But now they were out and on the track, and Bond rammed his foot down to the floor.
"Anyone after us?"
Bond had to shout above the noise of the diesel.
"No, wait! Yes, there's a man coming out of the huts, and another. They're waving and shouting at us. Now some more are coming out. Some of them's run off to the right. Another's gone back into the hut. He's come out with a rifle. He's lying down. He's firing!"
"Close the slot. Lie down on the floor." Bond glanced at the speedometer. 20. And they were on a slope. There was nothing more to get out of the machine. Bond concentrated on keeping the huge bucking wheels on the track. The cabin bounced and swayed on the springs. It was a job to keep his hands and feet on the controls. An iron fist clanged against the cabin, and another. What was the range? 400? Good shooting. But that would be the lot. He shouted,
"Take a look, honey. Open the slot an inch." The man's got up. He stopped firing. They're all looking after us, a whole crowd of them. Wait, there's something else. The dogs are coming. There's no one with them. They're just tearing down the track after us. Will they catch us?
Doesn't matter if they do. Come and sit by me, honey. Hold tight. Mind your head against the roof. Bond eased up the throttle. She was beside him. He grinned sideways at her.
Hell, honey. We've made it. When we get down to the lake, I'll stop and shoot up the dogs. If I know those brutes, I've only got to kill one, and the whole pack'll stop to eat him.
Bond felt her hand at his neck. She kept it there as they swayed and thundered down the track. At the lake, Bond went on 50 yards into the water and turned the machine round and put it in neutral. Through the oblong slot he could see the pack streaming round the last bend. He reached down for the rifle and pushed it through the aperture. Now the dogs were in the water and swimming. Bond kept his finger on the trigger and sprayed bullets into the middle of them. One floundered, kicking, then another and another. He could hear their snarling screams above the clatter of the engine. There was blood in the water. A fight had started. He saw one dog leap on one of the wounded ones and sink its teeth into the back of its neck. Now they all seemed to have gone berserk. They were milling around in the frothing, bloody water.
Bond emptied his magazine among them and dropped the gun on the floor. He said, "That's that, honey," and put the machine into gear and swung it round and began rolling at an easy speed across the shallow lake towards the distant gap in the mangrove that was the mouth of the river. For 5 minutes they moved along in silence. Then Bond put a hand on the girl's knee and said, "We should be all right now, honey. When they find the boss is dead, there'll be panic. I guess some of the brighter ones will try and get away to Cuba in the plane or the launch. They'll worry about their skins, not about us. All the same, we'll not take the canoe out until it's dark. I guess it's about 10 by now. We should be at the coast in an hour. Then we'll rest up and try and get in shape for the trip. Weather looks all right, and there'll be a bit more moon tonight. Think you can make it?" Her hand squeezed his neck.
"Of course I can, James. But what about you? Your poor body. It's nothing but burns and bruises. And what are those red marks across your stomach?"
"Tell you later. I'll be okay. But you tell me what happened to you last night. How in hell did you manage to get away from the crabs? What went wrong with that bastard's plan? All night long I could only think of you out there being slowly eaten to death. God, what a thing to have dreamed up. What happened?" The girl was actually laughing. Bond looked sideways. The golden hair was tousled, and the blue eyes were heavy with lack of sleep, but otherwise she might just be coming home from a midnight barbecue.
"That man thought he knew everything, silly old fool."
She might have been talking about a stupid schoolteacher.
"He is much more impressed by the black crabs than I am. To begin with, I don't mind any animal touching me. And anyway, those crabs wouldn't think of even nipping someone if they stay quite still and haven't got an open sore or anything. The whole point is that they don't really like meat. They live mostly on plants and things. If he was right, and he did kill a black girl that way, either she had an open wound or she must have died of fright. He must have wanted to see if I'd stand it, filthy old man. I only fainted down there at dinner because I knew he'd have something much worse for you."
"Well, I'm damned. I wish to heaven I'd known that. I thought of you being picked to pieces." The girl snorted.
"Of course, it wasn't very nice having my clothes taken off and being tied down to pegs in the ground. But those black men didn't dare touch me. They just made jokes and then went away. It wasn't very comfortable out there on the rock, but I was thinking of you and how I could get at Dr. No and kill him. Then I heard the crabs beginning to run. That's what we call it in Jamaica. And soon they came scurrying and rattling along, hundreds of them. I just lay still and thought of you. They walked round me and over me. I might have been a rock for all they cared. They tickled a bit. One annoyed me by trying to pull out a bit of my hair. But they don't smell or anything, and I just waited for the early morning when they crawl into holes and go to sleep. I got quite fond of them. They were company. Then they got fewer and fewer and finally stopped coming and I could move. I pulled at all the pegs in turn and then concentrated on my right-hand one. In the end I got it out of the crack in the rock and the rest was easy. I got back to the buildings and began scouting about. I got into the machine shop near the garage and found this filthy old suit. Then the conveyor thing started up not far away, and I thought about it, and I guessed it must be taking the guano through the mountain. I knew you must be dead by then."
The quiet voice was matter-of-fact.
"So I thought I'd get to the conveyor somehow and get through the mountain and kill Dr. No. I took a screwdriver to do it with."
She giggled.
"When we ran into each other, I'd have stuck it into you, only it was in my pocket and I couldn't get to it. I found the door in the back of the machine shop and walked through and into the main tunnel. That's all."
She caressed the back of his neck.
"I ran along, watching my step, and the next thing I knew was your head hitting me in the stomach."
She giggled again.
"Darling, I hope I didn't hurt you too much when we were fighting. My nanny told me always to hit men there."
Bond laughed. "She did she?" He reached out and caught her by the hair and pulled her face to him. Her mouth felt its way round his cheek and locked itself against his. The machine gave a sideways lurch. The kiss ended. They had hit the first mangrove roots at the entrance to the river.
Chapter 20. The Last Chapter. Slave Time.
"You're quite sure of all this?"
The acting governor's eyes were hunted, resentful. How could these things have been going on under his nose in one of Jamaica's dependencies? What would the Colonial Office have to say about it? He already saw the long, pale blue envelope marked "Personal, for addressee only," and the foolscap page with those very wide margins. "The Secretary of State for the Colonies has instructed me to express to you his surprise. "Yes, sir. Quite sure." Bond had no sympathy for the man. He hadn't liked the reception he had had on his last visit to King's House, nor the mean comments on Strangways and the girl. He liked the memory of them even less, now that he knew his friend and the girl were at the bottom of the Mona Reservoir.
Well, we mustn't let any of this get out to the press. You understand that? I'll send my report in to the Secretary of State by the next bag. I'm sure I can rely on your...
Excuse me, sir. The brigadier in command of the Caribbean Defence Force was a modern young soldier of 35. His military record was good enough for him to be unimpressed by relics from the Edwardian era of colonial governors, whom he collectively referred to as feather-hatted fuddy-duddies. I think we can assume that Commander Bond is unlikely to communicate with anyone except his department, and if I may say so, sir, I submit that we should take steps to clear up Crab Key without waiting for approval from London. I can provide a platoon ready to embark by this evening. HMS Narvik came in yesterday. If the programme of receptions and cocktail parties for her could possibly be deferred for 48 hours or so. The brigadier let his sarcasm hang in the air.
I agree with the brigadier, sir.
The voice of the police superintendent was edgy. Quick action might save him from a reprimand, but it would have to be quick.
And in any case, I shall have to proceed immediately against the various Jamaicans who appear to be implicated. I'll have to get the divers working at Mona. If this case is to be cleaned up, we can't afford to wait for London. As Commander Bond says, most of these Negro gangsters will probably be in Cuba by now. Have to get in touch with my opposite number in Havana and catch up with them before they take to the hills or go underground. I think we ought to move at once, sir.
There was silence in the cool, shadowy room where the meeting was being held. On the ceiling above the massive mahogany conference table, there was an unexpected dapple of sunlight. Bond guessed that it shone up through the slats of the jalousies from a fountain or a lily pond in the garden outside the tall windows. Far away, there was the sound of tennis balls being knocked about. Distantly, a young girl's voice called, "Smooth! You'll serve, Gladys!" The governor's children? Secretaries? From one end of the room, King George the Sixth. From the other end, the Queen looked down the table with grace and good humour.
"What do you think, colonial secretary?"
The governor's voice was hustled. Bond listened to the first few words. He gathered that Pleydell Smith agreed with the other two. He stopped listening. His mind drifted into a world of tennis courts and lily ponds and kings and queens, of London, of people being photographed with pigeons on their heads in Trafalgar Square, of the Forsythia that would soon be blazing on the bypass roundabouts, of May, the treasured housekeeper in his flat off the King's Road, getting up to brew herself a cup of tea. Here it was 11 o'clock. It would be 4 o'clock in London. Of the first tube trains beginning to run, shaking the ground beneath his cool, dark bedroom. Of the douce weather of England, the soft airs, the heat waves, the cold spells, the only country where you can take a walk every day of the year, Chesterfield's letters. And then Bond thought of Crab Key, of the hot, ugly wind beginning to blow, of the stink of the marsh gas from the mangrove swamps, the jagged, grey, dead coral, in whose holes the black crabs were now squatting, the black and red eyes moving swiftly on their stalks, as a shadow, a cloud, a bird, broke their small horizons. Down in the bird colony the brown and white and pink birds would be stalking in the shallows, or fighting, or nesting, while up on the Guanera the cormorants would be streaming back from their breakfast to deposit their milligram of rent to the landlord, who would no longer be collecting. And where would the landlord be? The men from the SS Blanche would have dug him out. The body would have been examined for signs of life and then put somewhere. Would they have washed the yellow dust off him and dressed him in his kimono while the captain radioed Antwerp for instructions? And where had Dr. No's soul gone to? Had it been a bad soul or just a mad one? Bond thought of the burned twist down in the swamp that had been Quarrel. He remembered the soft ways of the big body, the innocence in the grey, horizon-seeking eyes, the simple lusts and desires, the reverence for superstitions and instincts, the childish faults, the loyalty and even love that Quarrel had given him, the warmth, there was only one word for it, of the man. Surely he hadn't gone to the same place as Dr. No. Whatever happened to dead people, there was surely one place for the warm, and another for the cold. And which, when the time came, would he, Bond, go to? The colonial secretary was mentioning Bond's name. Bond pulled himself together. "Survived is quite extraordinary. I do think, sir, that we should show our gratitude to Commander Bond and to his service by accepting his recommendations. It does seem, sir, that he has done at least three-quarters of the job. Surely the least we can do is look after the other quarter." The Governor grunted. He squinted down the table at Bond. The chap didn't seem to be paying much attention. But one couldn't be sure with these Secret Service fellows. Dangerous chaps to have around, sniffing and snooping. And their damned chief carried a lot of guns in Whitehall. Didn't do to get on the wrong side of him. Of course there was something to be said for sending the Narvik. News would leak, of course. All the press of the world would be coming down on his head. But then suddenly the Governor saw the headlines. "Governor takes swift action. Island's strong man intervenes. The Navy's there." Perhaps, after all, it would be better to do it that way. Even go down and see the troops off himself. Yes, that was it, by Jove. Cargill of the Gleaner was coming to lunch. He'd drop a hint or two to the chap and make sure the story got proper coverage. Yes, that was it. That was the way to play the hand. The Governor raised his hands and let them fall flat on the table in a gesture of submission. He embraced the conference with a wry smile of surrender. "So I am overruled, gentlemen. Well, then..." The voice was avuncular, telling the children that just this once. "I accept your verdict. Colonial Secretary, will you please call upon the commanding officer of HMS Narvik and explain the position? In strict confidence, of course. Brigadier, I leave the military arrangements in your hands. Superintendent, you will know what to do." The Governor rose. He inclined his head regally in the direction of Bond. "And it only remains to express my appreciation to Commander, Bond, for his part in this affair. I shall not fail to mention your assistance, Commander, to the Secretary of State." Outside, the sun blazed down on the gravel sweep. The interior of the Hillman Minx was a Turkish bath. Bond's bruised hands cringed as they took the wheel. Pleidel Smith leant through the window. He said, "Ever heard the Jamaican expression, ras?" "No." "Ras, man, is a vulgar expression meaning, stuff it up. If I may say so, it would have been appropriate for you to have used the expression just now. However," Pleidel Smith gave a wave of his hand, which apologized for his chief and dismissed him, "is there anything else I can do for you? You really think you ought to go back to Bow Desert? They were quite definite at the hospital that they want to have you for a week." "Thanks," said Bond shortly, "but I've got to get back. See the girls, all right. Would you tell the hospital I'll be back tomorrow? You got off that signal to my chief. Urgent rates." "Well, then," Bond pressed the self-starter, "I guess that's the lot. You'll see the Jamaica Institute people about the girl, won't you? She really knows the hell of a lot about the natural history side of the island. Not from books, either. If they've got the right sort of job, I'd like to see her settled. I'll take her up to New York myself and see her through the operation. She'd be ready to start in a couple of weeks after that. Incidentally," Bond looked embarrassed, "she's really the hell of a fine girl. When she comes back, if you and your wife, you know, just so there's someone to keep an eye on her." Pleidel Smith smiled. He thought he had the picture. He said, "Don't worry about that. I'll see to it. Betty's rather a hand at that sort of thing. She'll like taking the girl under her wing. Nothing else? See you later in the week, anyway. That hospital's the hell of a place in this heat. You might care to spend a night or two with us before you go to New York. Glad to have you, both." "Thanks, and thanks for everything else." Bond put the car into gear and went off down the avenue of flaming tropical shrubbery. He went fast, scattering the gravel on the bends. He wanted to get the hell away from King's House, and the tennis, and the kings and queens. He even wanted to get the hell away from the kindly Pleidel Smith. Bond liked the man, but all he wanted now was to get back across the junction road to Bow Desert and away from the smooth world. He swung out past the sentry at the gates and onto the main road. He put his foot down. The night voyage under the stars had been without incident. No one had come after them. The girl had done most of the sailing. Bond had not argued with her. He had lain in the bottom of the boat, totally collapsed, like a dead man. He had woken once or twice and listened to the slap of the sea against the hull and watched her quiet profile under the stars. Then the cradle of the soft swell had sent him back to sleep and to the nightmares that reached out after him from Crab Key. He didn't mind them. He didn't think he would ever mind a nightmare now. After what had happened the night before, it would have to be strong stuff that would ever frighten him again. The crunch of a niggerhead against the hull had woken him. They were coming through the reef into Morgan's Harbour. The first quarter moon was up, and inside the reef the sea was a silver mirror. The girl had brought the canoe through under sail. They slid across the bay to the little fringe of sand, and the bows under Bond's head sighed softly into it. She had had to help him out of the boat and across the velvet lawn and into the house. He had clung to her and cursed her softly as she had cut his clothes off him and taken him into the shower. She had said nothing when she had seen his battered body under the lights. She had turned the water full on and taken soap and washed him down as if he had been a horse. Then she led him out from under the water and dabbed him softly dry with towels that were soon streaked with blood. He had seen her reach for the bottle of Milton. He had groaned and taken hold of the wash-basin and waited for it. Before she had begun to put it on him, she had come round and kissed him on the lips. She had said softly, "Hold tight, my darling, and cry. It's going to hurt." And as she splashed the murderous stuff over his body, the tears of pain had run out of his eyes and down his cheeks without shame. Then there had been a wonderful breakfast, as the dawn flared up across the bay, and then the ghastly drive over to Kingston to the white table of the surgery in the emergency ward. Clydal Smith had been summoned. No questions had been asked. Merthiolate had been put on the wounds and tannic ointment on the burns. The efficient negro doctor had written busily in the duty report. What? Probably just multiple burns and contusions. Then, with promises to come into the private ward on the next day, Bond had gone off with Clydal Smith to King's House and to the first of the meetings that had ended with the full-dress conference. Bond had enciphered a short signal to M via the Colonial Office, which he had coolly concluded with, "Regret must again request sick leave. Stop. Surgeon's report follows. Stop. Kindly inform armourer Smith and Wesson ineffective against flamethrower. End it." Now, as Bond swung the little car down the endless S-bends towards the North Shore, he regretted the jibe. M wouldn't like it. It was cheap. It wasted cipher groups. Oh, well. Bond swerved to avoid a thundering red bus with brown-skinned gal on the destination plate. He had just wanted M to know that it hadn't quite been a holiday in the sun. He would apologize when he sent in his written report. Bond's bedroom was cool and dark. There was a plate of sandwiches and a thermos full of coffee beside the turned-down bed. On the pillow was a sheet of paper with big, childish writing. It said, "You are staying with me tonight. I can't leave my animals. They were fussing. And I can't leave you. And you owe me slave time. I will come at 7. Your H." In the dusk, she came across the lawn to where Bond was sitting finishing his third glass of bourbon on the rocks. She was wearing a black-and-white striped cotton skirt and a tight sugar-pink blouse. The golden hair smelled of cheap shampoo. She looked incredibly fresh and beautiful. She reached out her hand, and Bond took it and followed her up the drive and along a narrow, well-trodden path through the sugar-cane. It wound along for quite a way through the tall, whispering, sweet-scented jungle. Then there was a patch of tidy lawn up against thick, broken stone walls and steps that led down to a heavy door whose edges glinted with light. She looked up at him from the door. "Don't be frightened. The cane's high and they're most of them out." Bond didn't know what he had expected. He had vaguely thought of a flat earthen floor and rather damp walls. There would be a few sticks of furniture, a broken bedstead covered with rags, and a strong zoo smell. He had been prepared to be careful about hurting her feelings. Instead, it was rather like being inside a very large, tidy cigar box. The floor and ceiling were of highly polished cedar that gave out a cigar box smell, and the walls were panelled with wide, split bamboo. The light came from a dozen candles in a fine silver chandelier that hung from the centre of the ceiling. High up in the walls there were three square windows through which Bond could see the dark blue sky and the stars. There were several pieces of good 19th-century furniture. Under the chandelier a table was laid for two with expensive-looking old-fashioned silver and glass. Bond said, "Honey, what a lovely room. From what you said, I thought you lived in a sort of zoo." She laughed delightedly. "I got out the old silver and things. It's all I've got. I had to spend the day polishing it. I've never had it out before. It does look rather nice, doesn't it? You see, generally there are a lot of little cages up against the wall. I like having them with me. It's company. But now that you're here..." She paused. "My bedroom's in there." She gestured at the other door. "It's very small, but there's room for both of us. Now come on.
I'm afraid it's cold dinner. Just lobsters and fruit.
Bond walked over to her. He took her in his arms and kissed her hard on the lips. He held her and looked down into the shining blue eyes. Honey, you're a wonderful girl. You're one of the most wonderful girls I've ever known. I hope the world's not going to change you too much. Do you really want to have that operation? I love your face, just as it is. It's part of you, part of all this. She frowned and freed herself.
You're not to be serious tonight. Don't talk about these things. I don't want to talk about them. This is my night with you. Please talk about love. I don't want to hear about anything else. Promise? Now come on. You sit there.
Bond sat down. He smiled up at her. He said, I promise. She said,
Here's the mayonnaise. It's not out of a bottle. I made it myself. And take some bread and butter.
She sat down opposite him and began to eat, watching him. When she saw that he seemed satisfied, she said,
Now you can start telling me about love. Everything about it. Everything you know.
Bond looked across into the flushed, golden face. The eyes were bright and soft in the candlelight, but with the same imperious glint they had held when he had first seen her on the beach, and she had thought he had come to steal her shells. The full red lips were open with excitement and impatience. With him she had no inhibitions. They were two loving animals. It was natural. She had no shame. She could ask him anything and would expect him to answer. It was as if they were already in bed together, lovers. Through the tight cotton bodice the points of her breasts showed hard and roused. Bond said, Are you a virgin?
Not quite. I told you. That man.
Well. Bond found he couldn't eat any more. His mouth was dry at the thought of her. He said, Honey, I can either eat or talk love to you. I can't do both.
You're going over to Kingston tomorrow. You'll get plenty to eat there. Talk love.
Bond's eyes were fierce blue slits. He got up and went down on one knee beside her. He picked up her hand and looked into it. At the base of the thumb, the Mount of Venus swelled luxuriously. Bond bent his head down into the warm, soft hand and bit softly into the swelling. He felt her other hand in his hair. He bit harder. The hand he was holding curled round his mouth. She was panting. He bit still harder. She gave a little scream and wrenched his head away by the hair.
"What are you doing?"
Her eyes were wide and dark. She had gone pale. She dropped her eyes and looked at his mouth. Slowly she pulled his head towards her. Bond put out a hand to her left breast and held it hard. He lifted her captive, wounded hand and put it round his neck. Their mouths met and clung, exploring. Above them the candles began to dance. A big hawk moth had come in through one of the windows. It whirred round the chandelier. The girl's closed eyes opened, looked at the moth. Her mouth drew away. She smoothed the handful of his hair back and got up, and without saying anything took down the candles one by one and blew them out. The moth whirred away through one of the windows. The girl stood away from the table. She undid her blouse and threw it on the floor. Then her skirt. Under the glint of moonlight she was a pale figure with a central shadow. She came to Bond and took him by the hand and lifted him up. She undid his shirt and slowly, carefully took it off. Her body, close to him, smelled of new-mown hay and sweet pepper. She led him away from the table and through a door. The filtering moonlight shone down on a single bed. On the bed was a sleeping bag, its mouth laid open. The girl let go his hand and climbed into the sleeping bag. She looked up at him. She said practically,
"I bought this today. It's a double one. It cost a lot of money. Take those off and come in. You promised. You owe me slave time. But do as you're told."
This concludes the reading of Dr. No by Ian Fleming. This book was read by Robert Whitfield. Blackstone patrons who enjoy this unabridged work also enjoy these Blackstone titles, also by Ian Fleming: Diamonds Are Forever, Casino Royale, and From Russia with Love. Other Blackstone mystery and suspense authors include many works by Eric Ambler, Len Dayton, and Dick Francis, among others. If you would like to obtain a complete catalogue of our titles, or our monthly update telling you about new releases and our new collection of books on CD, write to Blackstone Audiobooks, P.O. Box 969, Ashland, Oregon, zip code 97520. Or call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. You may also obtain the same information from our award-winning website. Our address, all one word, is www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.